From Pacifica, this is Democracy Now!
And so I would like to ask you to be upfront with the American people. Why did you lie to get us into a war that was not necessary and that has caused these kinds of casualties? Why?
Well, first of all, I haven't lied. I did not lie then.
Defense Secretary Donald Rumsfeld comes under fire from retired CIA analyst Ray McGovern at a speech in Atlanta. Rumsfeld was interrupted also by protesters repeatedly during his address. The newly released documents reveal the FBI has been monitoring School of the Americas Watch. We'll talk about government monitoring of peace groups, and we'll be joined by a journalist who has been targeted. And we'll go to Bolivia, where President Evo Morales has moved to nationalize the country's gas resources. And the documentary film Bullets in the Hood takes on gun violence.
It has been 8 months since the shooting of Timothy Stansberry occurred. I just want to know when we're going to get some justice. I know 8 people that has been shot and killed by guns.
All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez. In Nigeria, peace talks attempting to resolve the conflict in Darfur appear to have broken down. Earlier today, leaders of 2 rebel groups, the Justice and Equality Movement and a faction of the Sudan Liberation Army, said they could not accept an African Union-brokered plan without major changes. Meanwhile, a larger faction of the Sudan Liberation Army said it would accept the deal, although with reservations. In Somalia, the Bush administration is being accused of fomenting unrest through the support of warlords fighting Islamic militants in Mogadishu. A Somali government spokesperson said the U.S. government's backing is helping fuel a civil war that's led to many civilian deaths. Some 90 people were killed during the fighting in March, the worst violence Somalia has seen in years. In Mexico, over 1,000 police officers raided a town on the outskirts of Mexico City Thursday that was the site of a riot a day earlier. On Wednesday, demonstrators clashed with police, who tear gassed them for protesting the arrest of several farmers for selling flowers without a permit. The demonstrators took 6 police hostages, all of whom were released. At least 30 people were arrested and remain in custody. 2 journalists said police beat them to prevent them from filming. In East Timor, thousands of people have fled their homes in the capital of Dili amid rumors of an impending battle between the military and police. Last week, 4 people were killed and dozens of homes damaged when a protest of dismissed soldiers turned violent. Meanwhile, in Indonesia, politician and former militia leader Yurico Guterres was jailed Thursday to begin a 10-year sentence for human rights abuses during East Timor's 1999 independence vote. Guterres led a rampage of Indonesia-backed militias after East Timor voted to free itself from 24 years of Indonesian rule. At least 1,400 East Timorese were killed in the attacks. In Israel, Prime Minister Ehud Olmert installed his new government Thursday with a promise to impose permanent borders. Under Olmert's plan, 60,000 settlers living in isolated areas on the West Bank will be moved to Israel's main settlement blocks, home to over 340,000 people. Those settlement blocks would then become part of Israel's permanent borders. Meanwhile, Hamas leader Khaled Mashal has announced Hamas would be willing to move towards peace with Israel if it agreed to give up its West Bank settlements and recognize Palestinian rights. Here in the United States, FEMA has announced it's closing down the local office tasked with planning the long-term recovery of New Orleans. FEMA says it made the decision because local officials have failed to begin adequate planning. New Orleans officials say the government has again abandoned their city. Deputy Mayor Greg Meffert said, quote, "We can't plan on a paper napkin." For the first time ever, the Justice Department is using the 1965 Voting Rights Act to prosecute an African American for racially discriminating against whites. Ike Brown, a local Democratic Party leader, is accused of intimidating and insulting white voters and candidates. Brown's a well-known political organizer who's run several successful campaigns. The government has one main witness, a country prosecutor. The prosecutor, Ricky Walker, says Brown recruited a black opponent to run against him solely because he's white. And finally, we have this sad news from Washington, D.C. Damu Smith, the legendary peace activist, died earlier this morning. The founder of Black Voices for Peace and the National Black Environmental Justice Network spent years fighting against environmental racism, particularly in the South. He was a key leader in the anti-apartheid movement and fought police brutality in Washington, D.C. and around the country. Damu was diagnosed with colon cancer last year on a peace mission in the occupied territories. He then not only fought for his life, but against racial disparities in the healthcare system. In September, he spoke at the first annual Unvarnished Truth Awards in Washington, D.C.
I'm tired of seeing hungry children get up in the morning. I'm tired of seeing people living with AIDS and don't have the power to help themselves because they don't have the resources to do so. I'm tired of seeing people tortured and oppressed. I'm tired of seeing all of these things. And as Fannie Lou Hamer said, well, she's sick and tired of being sick and tired. And so she understood in order not to be sick and tired of being sick and tired, she had to get up off of herself after she prayed to her God and said, give me the strength to do what I need to do to transform this world. And so out of the poverty of Mississippi and the violence and terrorism of Mississippi, this woman, Fannie Lou Hamer, rose up to do what so many of us have refused to do, and that is to speak truth to power and not be afraid to do it.
Damu Smith is survived by his daughter Aisha. His legacy lives on in all those who fight for justice.
All our enemies, bring
Michael Franti, we can bomb the world. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez.
And welcome to all of our listeners and viewers. We turn now to Defense Secretary Donald Rumsfeld. On Thursday, he traveled to Atlanta to speak at the Southern Center for International Studies. Minutes after he began speaking, a protester held up a yellow banner that read, guilty of war crimes, and then began to shout. Moments later, Defense Secretary Rumsfeld was interrupted again by another member of the audience.
Fly to the American people! You've lied to the rats, all would pay for the war! You've lied about everything!
And then it happened again. By the end of his speech, security had escorted three protesters out of the building. Then Rumsfeld began taking questions from the audience. One of those who posed the question was Ray McGovern, who spent 27 years as a CIA analyst.
And so I would like to ask you to be upfront with the American people. Why did you lie to get us into a war that was not necessary and that has caused these kinds of casualties? Why?
Well, first of all, I haven't lied. I did not lie then. Colin Powell didn't lie. He spent weeks and weeks with the Central Intelligence Agency people and prepared a presentation that I know he believed was accurate. And he presented that to the United Nations. The president spent weeks and weeks with the Central Intelligence people, and he went to the American people and made a presentation. I'm not in the intelligence business. They gave the world their honest opinion. It appears that there were not weapons of mass destruction there.
You said you knew where they were.
I did not. I said I knew where suspect sites were, and
you
we
said,
were just...
You said you knew where they were, near Tikrit, near Baghdad, and northeast, south, and west of there. Those are your words.
My words were that... No. Wait a minute. Let him stay 1 second. Just a second.
This is America, huh?
Yeah.
Go ahead.
Yeah.
You're getting plenty of play, sir.
I just like an honest answer.
I'm giving it to you.
We're talking about lies, and your allegation that there was bulletproof evidence of ties between Al-Qaeda and Iraq. Was that a lie, or were you misled?
Zarqawi was in Baghdad during the pre-war period. That is a fact.
Zarqawi? He was in the north of Iraq in a place where Saddam Hussein had no rule.
He was also in Baghdad.
Yeah, when he needed to go to the hospital. Come on, these people aren't idiots. They know the story.
You are... Let me give you an example. It's easy for you to make a charge, but why do you think that the men and women in uniform, every day when they came out of Kuwait and went into Iraq, put on chemical weapon protective suits? Because they liked the style? They honestly believed that there were chemical weapons. Saddam Hussein had used chemical weapons on his own people previously. He'd used them on his neighbor, the Iranians. And they believed he had those weapons. We believed he had those weapons.
That's what we call a non sequitur. It doesn't matter what the troops believe. It matters what you believe.
I think, Mr. Secretary, the debate is over. We have other questions. Okay. Courtesy to the audience.
That was Defense Secretary Donald Rumsfeld responding to questions by retired CIA analyst Ray McGovern at an event in Atlanta on Thursday. Ray McGovern joins us in our studio now from Atlanta. Some of the media said alleged former CIA analyst. Ray McGovern has been with the agency for more than a quarter of a century and was one of the top briefers of Vice President George H.W. Bush. He's now co-founder of the Veteran Intelligence Professionals for Sanity, VIPs. Welcome to Democracy Now, Ray.
Thank you, Amy.
Well, tell us about this event yesterday, a quite raucous event, interruptions, and then your questioning, a very rare moment for one of the more insulated government officials to be questioned by, well, a former CIA analyst.
Well, Amy, just listening to this little clip here, I find it scary. These were ostensibly educated, normal people, and their reaction was very much like the one that Goebbels stirred up. You could see it was a very unfriendly audience to anyone who posed any kind of a question to the defense secretary. So, and listening to it, I'm sort of scared, because if this is indicative of the brainwashing that has taken place, it's going to be a long, long struggle to speak truth to power, as Fannie Lou Hamer so famously said, and Damo Smith as well.
Well, Ray, let's go through the questions and how the secretary responded to you. Issue, the last one, of Zarqawi saying that there is a link between Al-Qaeda and Iraq.
Yeah, that's the best they could come up with after all this misinformation with Cheney saying there were contacts between Iraqis and people in Prague and so forth. Zarqawi was up in the north part of the country. He had no contact with Saddam Hussein. Saddam Hussein was not ruling that part of the area.
Wasn't the U.S.?
The U.S. and the Kurds were up there. They could have got Zarqawi in a moment, but they chose not to. So it was completely disingenuous. And for the people not to be able to listen to that, to hear it, but simply join in the applause for Rumsfeld was a bit disquieting.
And when Secretary Rumsfeld responds about the troops believing that they were chemical weapons because they were wearing uniforms or chemical suits, your response?
Well, talk about disingenuity. I mean, sure, they wore chemical weapons because Rumsfeld and his generals ordered them to. This proves nothing other than they went through with this charade. The Australian troops wore no such protective covering because they knew there were no weapons there. The Australians knew that these weapons were a figment of the propaganda put out by our Defense Department, so they blithely went in there without any protective covering. So it was all a charade, and I suppose the good news is that finally someone had a chance to ask Don Rumsfeld. If I were in Washington, I never would have got into a session where Rumsfeld spoke. I have to give him credit that he took questions and answers. But you know, it's really interesting that when I walked into the place, I wangled a ticket very surreptitiously. I was met with this little blurb on Donald Rumsfeld, and as I read it, I had to chuckle. It says, there's going to be a question and answer period, but please adhere to these guidelines. Refrain from using the word lie in relation to the war in Iraq. Do not question the Secretary's personal responsibility for torture, and please don't discuss first use of nuclear weapons against Iran. If you violate these guidelines, you'll be immediately removed from the auditorium and flown to an undesignated prison location somewhere in Eastern Europe and tortured. Thank you for your cooperation. The world cannot wait. A wonderful, wonderful group. Those were the folks that spoke up and tried to brace Donald Rumsfeld with the lies and their charges of him being, and he is arguably, a war criminal, and we shouldn't shy away from saying that.
And Ray, when you were asking the questions, at one point off camera, you were saying, this is America. What was happening at that point?
Well, curiously enough, a very large man came down with a white coat on, and he stuck his elbow into my chest and started pushing me back, and I pushed back, literally and figuratively. And it was the moment of truth. Would Don Rumsfeld want me thrown out of there, having asked in a very civil manner, simply pointed questions, or would he ask them not to remove me? He chose the wiser cost. I first thought that this was him being gracious, but when I thought of the PR debacle it would have been for him to have me removed after simply posing these questions, which nobody else has the guts to pose them, then he chose the wiser course from a PR point of view as well.
Ray McGovern, I want to thank you very much for being with us, analyst with the CIA for more than a quarter of a century and one of the top briefers of Vice President George H.W. Bush, co-founder of Veteran Intelligence Professionals for Sanity. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, as we move now to the government and spying.
Well, yesterday, the ACLU released evidence showing that the FBI has been monitoring the peace group School of America's Watch. SOA Watch was founded by Father Roy Bourgeois in 1990. The group conducts research on the U.S. Army School of the Americas, now renamed the Western Hemisphere Institute for Security Cooperation. The school, which is located at Fort Benning, Georgia, trains hundreds of soldiers from Latin America each year and is funded entirely by the U.S. government. SOA Watch holds an annual vigil calling for the closure of the facility. Last year, the vigil drew 19,000 people.
SOA Watch is the latest organization the ACLU is found to have been subject to U.S. government spying in the name of counterterrorism. In December, NBC News revealed the existence of a secret Pentagon database to track intelligence gathered inside the U.S., including information on anti-war protests and rallies. The database included information on counter-military recruiting meetings held at a Quaker meeting house in Lake Worth, Florida, and anti-nuclear protests staged in Nebraska on the 50th anniversary of the U.S. atomic bombing of Nagasaki. And in March, the ACLU uncovered files showing the FBI had been monitoring and possibly infiltrating the Thomas Merton Center, which is a Pittsburgh-based peace center actively opposed to the war in Iraq. We're joined in a Firehouse studio now by Ann Beeson, Associate Legal Director of the ACLU, and we're joined by Dave Lippman. He's a freelance journalist who's suing the FBI for spying on him during the Free Trade Area of the Americas Summit in Miami in 2003 in Washington. We're joined by the coordinator for SOA Watch. Ann Beeson, what have you learned?
Well, we have had our fears confirmed that in this environment after 9/11, we've seen both a steady erosion of the, I think, quintessential American right to protest government policies and an expansion of monitoring by agencies from the FBI to the Pentagon to the National Security Agency. Unfortunately, these documents about the massive surveillance of School of the Americas Watch are just some documents of a wide campaign that we've been involved in around the country on behalf of about 150 different peaceful protest groups that protest a whole range of issues, not just the war in Iraq and not just the School of the Americas Watch, but also environmental activists and animal rights activists, all now being targeted by our government's counterterrorism units.
Well, and this seems a almost complete replay of the 1970s when the government was involved in massive spying on all kinds of legitimate groups of dissent. And obviously there were congressional hearings at the time and new legislation passed. How has the Bush administration been able to get away with just completely renewing this all over again?
Well, that's exactly right, and I'm glad you raised that, because one of the things that's remarkable when you look at what's happening today is the utter lack of imagination of the FBI. In fact, you see precisely the same groups being targeted now as terrorist sympathizers that used to be targeted as communist sympathizers during the Cold War. And that includes the American Friends Service Committee and other Quaker groups. It includes groups like the National Lawyers Guild, a whole range of groups that were spied on then are now being spied on again today. And in fact, as you say, there were protections we had thought put in place during that era when Americans cried out and said, this is not the American way. We can't have the FBI routinely spying on protesters. And right after 9/11, then Attorney General John Ashcroft basically overturned many of the guidelines and in the last several decades had limited this kind of spying on protest groups.
We're going to talk to two entities that have been spied on. We'll go to Washington for School of the Americas Watch, and then in our studio, well, Dave Littman, an entity in himself, suing the FBI for spying on him, freelance journalist. This is Democracy Now! We'll be back in a minute. Let's Impeach the President by Neil Young. His new anti-war album is called Living with War. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez, our guests, Arianne Beeson, Associate Legal Director of the ACLU, Eric LeCompte in Washington, D.C., coordinator of SOA Watch, and Dave Littman, a freelance journalist suing the FBI for spying on him. Eric LeCompte, let's go to you. What do you understand about what the FBI is doing in your case?
Well, with the ACLU, what we have learned is that since at least 2001, the FBI has been spying on us and on our gatherings that take place at the gates of Fort Benning every year. Every year at Fort Benning, we gather there to call for a closure of the School of the Americas, a school that has graduated over 60,000 Latin American soldiers. These soldiers from Bolivia, Colombia, El Salvador have returned to their home countries and committed the worst human rights abuses in Latin American history. And what we've found is that as we've gathered there, the FBI has been monitoring us, has been spying on us, and has been recording what we're doing. Now, I think one of the things that's very crucial to understand about these first 50-odd pages that the FBI was forced to release by the ACLU is in these pages, it says consistently in their surveillance over us over these last 5 years that we are a nonviolent group, that we are a peaceful group. They note, in fact, in their October of 2003 memos, how specifically our leadership of this movement maintains a spirit of nonviolence at the gatherings. And still, with this kind of information shared throughout the entire memos, they're still spying on us. And I think just so that all the listeners can really understand what this means, I think it is important for me just to take a moment to describe who are the people who are being spied on. Who are we as a movement trying to end torture? You know, when we gather every year at the gates of Fort Benning, calling for an end to civilian targeted warfare in Latin America, calling for an end to torture, it's a pretty diverse group that gathers. Those who gather include Catholic bishops and Catholic nuns, the ministers of the Presbyterian Church and Methodist Church, as a matter of fact, ministers from just about every mainline religion. National veterans organizations, labor unions come in force, like the United Auto Workers and the Steel Workers of America. We have with us the presidents of universities and the principals of high schools, Buddhist monks. These are some of those who gather, and these are the kinds of people that are being spied on. And I think what this illustrates right now in this national security state that is coming into being is that none of us are safe. Our movement comes right from the middle America, and with this kind of surveillance, FBI surveillance, Homeland Security surveillance taking place on our movement, it illustrates, I believe, that none of us are safe.
Well, Eric, was there anything that was discovered in those memos, FBI memos that were released to you that would in any way remotely raise suspicion or basis for counterterrorism being invoked as a reason for spying on you?
Not even one single iota. There is not anything within the documents. Granted, there is quite a bit that they have blacked out in the documents that we received, but there's nothing that would describe us as violent or as a threat. Again, it's just the opposite. They hammer home the point that we're a peaceful organization. And I think even to illustrate this even further, you know, we have 130 members of Congress who are active supporters of our movement. As a matter of fact, in the next week, as early as a week from now, we're expecting a vote to close the School of the Americas in Congress. Now, with that kind of high political profile that our movement has and that we've had over the years, and again, our spirit of nonviolence, to note that at least since 2001, we've been under active surveillance, that we've been being spied on by the FBI, I have to say it really angers me, because our government should be investigating the torture and the assassinations committed by the graduates of this school, and instead, they're using our tax dollars, our precious resources, to spy on peaceful Catholic bishops and Presbyterian ministers instead of using our resources to close this school and investigate the atrocities that these graduates have committed. It's shameful, and what it does illustrate is that we are being monitored for our political views, views which are probably different than this current administration, that we believe torture should end and that there should not be civilian targeted warfare in Latin America funded by our tax dollars.
The founder SOA Watch is Father Roy Bourgeois, who is a Marinol priest who worked throughout Latin America and now lives outside the, well, what used to be known as the School of the Americas in a little office, and that is the heart of this movement. Every year, massive protests there. At our website, democracynow.org, you can see the images of protest among those who has come to the School of the Americas Watch protest is Martin Sheen, the actor, Dan Berrigan, who's celebrating his 85th birthday, Father Dan Berrigan, Martin Sheen, who when he crosses the line in his protests, whether at Los Alamos or at the School of the Americas, has said, you know, he's the president on West Wing, which is ending now, the president of the United States. He says, I work for General Electric, which owns NBC, which has West Wing. I work for General Electric for a living, and I do this, as he crosses the line, to stay alive. I wanted to ask Dave Lippman in our studio. You were working for Free Speech Radio News, which provides news for community radio stations in Pacifica around the country, covering the FDA protest in November of 2003. What happened?
I had just parked my car in a municipal garage, and it was about 2 hours later I happened to be standing on the corner when I saw my truck go by behind a tow truck. Then I realized that the street that I had seen that was blocked off because they were examining my truck in and breaking the windows in it. It took me 2 days to get it back, and I found padlocks on the back broken and everything quite disordered. So the ACLU came into the case, the ACLU of Florida, and eventually they discovered documents indicating that several different law enforcement agencies have been involved in not entirely clear ways, including the Miami Police, the Broward County Sheriff's, a neighboring county, and the FBI. It's not clear what the exact motive was of taking that vehicle. It was not the only vehicle taken or damaged, but it does say in the documents that that the vehicle was followed from North Carolina, where I live, to Miami because I'm a protester with a known history.
A protester with a history.
Right, and the incident report actually does admit that the Broward County Sheriff's, FBI, and Miami-Dade were involved in the damage, right? But that doesn't give a reason.
Only the reason that I'm a protester with a known history.
What's that history?
I have spent a lot of time as a performing artist, but doing political material. I do music and comedy around the country, but I was involved in North Carolina in local anti-war activities, local organizations, campus community organizations starting around 2001. And so I had been doing that for the last 2 years.
And what kind of comedy do you do?
I play a singing CIA agent, which is a little ironic, I guess, in this case.
Ann Beeson, what does an individual do in this case?
Well, anyone, of course, that is an active member of any organization or is an active protester can try to get a copy of their FBI file through the Freedom of Information Act. That is, in fact, the tool that we've used to expose all of these examples of spying so far. So you can fight back by exposing these records, and we are pressuring Congress to restore the guidelines that limit domestic spying, and there is some movement as a result of this national project for members of Congress to support that kind of restoration of our rights to protest.
Vermont Senator Leahy has been playing a key role, also mm-hmm. demanding to know about what's happening to peace activists in Vermont since information came out in the mm-hmm. database, I think Pentagon or FBI database, that they are being targeted, groups like AFSC.
That's right. Another important thing to note is that part of this is a result of government funding of supposed counterterrorism efforts. Again, something you saw back in the 60s and 70s. All of these dollars are flowing to the Miami Police Department, et cetera, and these departments around the country, and they're being told, oh, you've got to find a terrorist somewhere. Well, what are they doing? They're wasting these resources on investigation of peaceful protesters.
And for citizens who want to be able to get a hold of their FBI files, has it become more difficult in recent years? Have they become more stringent in terms of giving people access to these records?
They have cracked down a bit, and so we've actually been a bit surprised at the amount of information that we have. It makes us wonder what they're not giving us, because as you heard with regard to School of the Americas Watch, many of the documents we're receiving on these groups are heavily redacted. Now, we're going to continue to litigate to try to get access to some of the redacted versions of those files, but, I suppose we could say at least there's a little hope that they're giving us some of these records and we're able to expose
it. Is Dave Littman still being monitored?
I don't think we know. Do you know, Dave? Have you heard anything through your case?
I have no clue. We did do a Freedom of Information Act to the FBI regarding this case before filing a lawsuit, mm-hmm. which came up with nothing.
Yes. So, see, not everyone is as fortunate as we've been with regard to School of America's Watch and the Merton Center and the American Friends Service Committee in getting these files, which, again, makes you wonder what else they're hiding.
Can Congress just say, stop it?
Absolutely, they could and they should, and we should all encourage them to stop this. Well, that's a very good question, and that's why we all need to keep speaking out, exposing these ridiculous examples, and getting more people to join us and calling for really a restoration of the American right to protest.
If I remember correctly, with the FTAA protests, the Free Trade Area of the Americas protests in Miami, the Miami Police Department was given something like $8 million to deal with this peaceful protest. So now we know where some of the money went.
Absolutely. And even people who don't necessarily support the views of many of the groups that we're representing around the country have to say, what are they doing with our tax dollars? Couldn't they be spending it on something that would actually make us a little secure, even if you're concerned about security?
Well, back in the 70s with COINTELPRO, the FBI not only conducted surveillance, but conducted active attempts to create divisions and to lure people into criminal activities. And do you find some of that happening as well or not?
We know as a result of this same project that the FBI has sent confidential informants into mainstream groups like Greenpeace and People for the Ethical Treatment of Animals. We don't know exactly what those confidential informants are doing, but because those are the details that are redacted, but we know that they're there, and we absolutely are concerned that the same kind of provocation is happening as a result of these confidential informants inside these groups.
Well, we'll certainly continue to follow the story. I want to thank you, Ann Beeson, for being with us, Associate Legal Director of the ACLU, Eric LeCompte, who is with us in Washington, of SOA Watch, and Dave Lippman of, at the time was working for Free Speech TV and continues, Free Speech Radio, and continues to work around the country, both as an entertainer and as a reporter. As we move now to our next segment, in South America, leaders from Argentina, Bolivia, Brazil, and Venezuela gathered Thursday for an emergency summit to discuss Bolivia's decision to nationalize its natural gas fields and refineries. President Evo Morales' May Day announcement took many in the region by surprise. Bolivia is threatening to evict any foreign company in 6 months if it doesn't renegotiate its contract and hand over control of production to the government. Brazil and Argentina will likely be affected most by the decision, since they import large quantities of Bolivia's gas. On Thursday, Venezuelan President Hugo Chavez praised Evo Morales' decision.
We support Bolivia that is pointing in the same direction that Venezuela is pointing. We have recovered the control of our natural resources and our mineral riches in a very long and difficult process that even cost us an attempted coup. I can tell you that the process in Bolivia will in no way be traumatic, and I'm sure that everything will turn out well.
That was Venezuelan President Hugo Chavez. Meanwhile, Evo Morales defended his call, saying the country's natural resources must be controlled by the people of Bolivia, not international corporations.
And we are going to defend the natural resources. If before Bolivia was no man's land, now it is someone's land. It is the land of Bolivians, especially the indigenous and original people. Private companies, oil companies, transnational companies, if they want to come here and they want to respect Bolivian laws, they are welcome. We are going to make them respect them. But the companies that don't want to respect Bolivian laws, that don't want to subordinate themselves to the state, the law, may bad things come to them. The natural resources must be liberated, which means the natural resources must pass to the hands of the Bolivian state under the control of the Bolivian people. And that has begun. And we are going to continue our work without any fear.
To discuss the latest in Bolivia, we're joined now in Washington, D.C. by Larry Burns, director of the Council on Hemispheric Affairs. Welcome to Democracy Now!
Hi, Amy.
Can you talk about this very dramatic announcement of the nationalizing of gas in Bolivia?
Well, you know, I don't quite understand why people say it's dramatic when throughout his campaign, Evo Morales stressed the fact that there's going to be a takeover, a nationalization of the gas and oil. I think probably what is most dramatic is that here you had a leader who came forth with campaign rhetoric and then actually implemented that rhetoric after taking office. In recent years, we've had multiple presidents in Bolivia and Ecuador and Argentina were sort of pushed out of office by demonstrations in the streets because these individuals didn't fulfill their commitments that they had made during the campaign period. They reneged on these commitments, saying that, yes, we wanted to stand up to the IMF, but we can't because we need outside resources, and the only way to get them is to conform to the system. And I think that this is an extraordinary achievement in that he really went through with it, although I feel that this is not really terribly challenging to the energy companies, the private multinational energy companies, that they can relate to what Morales has done at no great cost to their financial situation, except that their profits will be somewhat less.
And Larry Burns, it seems, though, interestingly, that in this particular case, those most affected economically are the countries that now have left-leaning governments. The Spanish government, the socialist government of Spain, which has Spain has much investment in the region, as well as Brazil and Argentina, the main users of Bolivia's gas. But the political impact obviously reverberates in Washington more, because this kind of idea could spread.
Well, that's a good point. What we have here are different variants of left and socialists. Zapatero is as much socialist as, I guess, the Chilean political system is socialist. Tony Blair belongs to the Socialist International. In Latin America, you have really a significant division between someone like Castro and Chavez and now Morales, and really New Deal reformers like Kirchner and Lula. And it's important, I think it's generally perceived by all those involved, that what you want to do is to maintain this broad coalition, because the United States would like to see nothing better than to see Lula and Morales split and Chavez come down on the side of backing Morales. And since Argentina and Brazil will be adversely affected by any price increase, I mean, not dramatically, but still affected, there is the possibility of division here. But I think that all of these people are wise enough to realize that they must contain this damage, that they must, and perhaps Morales made an error in calling out the troops that perhaps raised the theatrics of it, but still it's all important to me to limit the damage done to this coalition, which is now becoming increasingly formidable throughout Latin America.
Larry Burns of the Council on Hemispheric Affairs, can you talk about the Bolivian workers, the people who have taken to the streets repeatedly, demanding what Evo Morales has done?
Well, we're talking about the poorest nation in South America and the second poorest nation in all of Latin America. It's a nation that has always depended upon its extractive industries, silver, lead, copper, and of course the hydrocarbons. It has the second largest natural gas field in South America. It's an extremely important country. The people, the citizenry of the country, have always been living on the margin. There's a tiny elite that has benefited from the economic system there. You had great families like the Patino family, a famous tin family, that benefited from the economics, even though the vast majority of the population operated outside of the system. The people of the Altiplano were the viewers of history rather than the participants in history. And whenever there was those rare opportunities, when there was a leftist who came to power, he was soon sort of eliminated by either the internal system or the U.S. intelligence factors. So this becomes an important moment for Bolivia, because in a sense it signifies that a recuperation has taken place of the resources, and there is at least some distant prospect that these resources will be used for authentic economic development.
Larry Burns, I want to thank you for being with us, Director of the Council on Hemispheric Affairs in Washington, D.C. When we come back from our break, we go to a bus tour against gun violence. Stay with us.
Don't. Here's what I want you all to do for me.
Bang! Caught you looking for the same thing. It's a new thing. Check out this I bring. Uh-oh, the road below the level, cause I'm living low next to the base.
Come on!
Turn up the radio. They're claiming I'm a criminal. But now I wonder how. Some people never know. The enemy could be the Frank Guardian. I'm now a hooligan. I rock the party and clear all the madness. I'm not a racist. Preach to teach the
cause some they never had this.
Number one. Never wanna run about the gun. I wasn't licensed to have one. The minute they see me, fear me. I'm the epitome, a public enemy. Used, abused, without clues. I refuse to blow a fuse. They even had it on the news.
Don't believe the hype. Don't believe the hype. Don't believe the hype.
Yes, was the start of my last jam. So here it is again, another death jam. But since I gave you all a little something that I knew you lacked, they still consider me a new jack. All the critics you can hang on my hold the rope, but they hope to the Pope and pray it ain't dope. The follower of Farrakhan, he'll tell me that you understand until you hear the man. They'll book up the new school rap game. Writers treat me like Coltrane, insane. Yes to them, but to me, I'm a different kind. We're brothers on the same mind, unblind. Caught in the middle end, not surrendering. I don't rhyme for the sake of riddling. Some claim that I'm a smuggler. Some say I never heard of ya. A rap burglar, false media. We don't need it, do we?
It's fake, that's what it be to you, dig me? Yo, Terminator X, step up on the stand and show these people what time it is, boy.
Don't believe the hype. Public Enemy here on Democracy Now!, democracynow.org. The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez.
We end today's program looking at the issue of gun violence. Downtown Community Television, located in the same Firehouse Studios we are broadcasting out of, is launching an anti-gun violence tour in New York City and the tri-state area. The tour features the film Bullets in the Hood, a Bed-Stuy story, produced at DCTV. The film was made by two 19-year-olds raised in Brooklyn's public housing projects who lost 11 friends to gun violence in the streets of New York City. Instead of picking up a gun, they picked up cameras and made a movie to try and put an end to the violence.
The film focuses on the fatal shooting of Timothy Stansbury by a police officer on the roof of a Bed-Stuy housing project January 24, 2004. He was 19. His friend Terrence Fisher was standing behind him when he was shot. Terrence documented the tense hours and days after the shooting with a fellow filmmaker. The result was the film Bullets in the Hood. It's been screened at national and international film festivals, including Sundance, where it won the 2005 Special Jury Prize in Short Filmmaking. We are joined right now by one of the people who made that film, Terrence Fisher. We're also joined by John Alpert, who heads up Downtown Community Television. We're going to show the clip in a minute and talk about, though, I wanted to ask John if you could talk about this tour. The film was made a little while ago, but now you're taking it on tour as mayors around the country deal with gun violence in a summit. You're doing it in a different way.
Yeah, we thought that one of the things that might help this, because so far the problem seems to be proving insoluble, is basically a grassroots effort. And if the people in their own communities can basically begin to fix something that's incredibly broken. We were at a school yesterday. There were 125 kids there. And the principal, a guy that comes from the neighborhood, said anybody who has lost someone to gun violence, a relative or a close friend, raised their hand, and every single hand went up. And when he said, anybody know a kid that has a gun? And every single hand went up. I mean, it's insane. I spent last summer in Baghdad, and a young American is two young Americans every day are dying in Baghdad. Every 3 hours, a young person like Terrence is being shot and killed in the streets. It's an astonishing epidemic. And we thought that this powerful film made by a young person who could be running around on the streets with a gun, but instead is running around with a camera, can serve as an inspiration. And basically, young people have to fix this themselves. They have to make that decision. Otherwise, the only thing that's really being talked about is more cops and more guns.
But John, interestingly, in national media coverage in recent years, as the crime rate has continued to drop, you see almost no attention now to the issue of gun violence and crime in a lot of neighborhoods around the country. It's almost as if the problem has disappeared.
Well, we can toss statistics or we can ask Terrence. I mean, is your neighborhood safer now than it was, or do more kids have guns?
I mean, it's safe now. I mean, like, a lot of people realizing what's going on, and we trying our best to, like, you know, put an end to whatever's going on right now. That's bad.
But are kids still getting killed?
I mean, no. I mean, people in my community don't die every day. I mean, things just happen often, like, you know.
Well, we want to go to a clip of your film. But before we do, since, John, you're going to have to leave us as the film, we play a clip of it. Your film, Baghdad ER, is going to air on May 21st on HBO. Just right. Got a big write-up by Bob Herbert in the New York Times op-ed page. How do you contrast the working on these two different films? I mean, Terrence was a filmmaker here. You were quite involved.
Right. Terrence made a great film, and he made a film that maybe I couldn't make because he was able to talk to the kids in the neighborhood, to the people who have really been suffering in a very intimate way. But it's sort of the same thing. It's war in Baghdad, and it's war in Brooklyn. And you know, maybe Terrence's neighborhood is safer this month, but the principal didn't think that. And he says, I'm putting a lot of effort into these kids, and they're all going to die.
We're going to go now to a clip of Bullets in the Hood.
It has been 8 months since the shooting of Timothy Stansberry occurred. I just want to know when we're going to get some justice. I know 8 people that has been shot and killed by guns. I just want to introduce you a few of them right now. This is Kevin West, AKA Castro. He was a friend of the block. He was like a brother to me, big brother. He was shot and killed by a gun. His name Jamel, AKA Ja. He has been shot and killed by a gun. And he was close to everybody that was on the block. He has Stoppo right here, AKA Pop. He had been shot and killed by a gun, and he was well known to the block. This is the last mural right here. Timothy Stansberry, AKA Drag. We called him Drag because his favorite rapper was Drag On. Drag, I love you, dog. My heart, man. Word up, man. And this is the last spot. Timothy had got shot. I'm 19 years old right now. It could be me next. It could be you. You never know. It's just a lot of gun violence going on in my community right now. I just want to know when it's going to stop.
An excerpt of the documentary Bullets in the Hood, a Bed-Stuy story. Filmmaker Terrence Fisher joins us in the studio today. We're also joined by Phyllis Claiborne, the mother of Timothy Stansberry, who was shot dead by a police officer January 2004 and is the focus of the film. I wanted to ask you about your son and what happened.
From what I'm to understand, on the night of the 24th of January, he was coming from a party on his way to pick up some CDs to go back to the party when he was approached by an officer, and he was shot and killed on his way up the stairs. He hadn't even reached through the doorstep yet, and this is when he was fatally shot by the officer, Richard Neary.
He was actually coming over the roof from one building to another in the neighborhood. I remember writing about the incident, and the officers had their guns drawn.
Yes.
Right on a roof patrol.
Yes, yes, doing a vertical, what they call it, a vertical patrol. From what I'm to understand, again, is that they were coming from the party because they wanted to take a shortcut. Instead of going down 5 flights of steps, they took the shortcut over the roof to go down 1 flight, to come back over to 1 flight, because if they had taken the steps, they had to take 5 steps down, 5 steps up, so they just took a shortcut to go over, and that's what happened.
And what has happened since that shooting? Did anything happen to the officer? Or?
Well, I call it a promotion because he's in a safe mode right now. He's now a delegate for PBA. I don't think he'll ever be faced with charges, and that's like a slap in my face because of the fact that I work for NYPD as well. I figured that they would have given him some disciplinary acts, but they haven't. Why? I don't know. I would like to know why. And I have a lot of questions because the commissioner himself said it was unjustifiable. I have not seen any justification on this situation yet. So to me, again, it's a slap in my face. And it's saying to me that it's okay when police officers do these types of things and they can get away with it. And this makes the people think that the city is corrupt with cops if they continue to allow them to do this and not be reprimanded for the things that they do.
Terrence, you knew Timothy?
Yes, he's like a brother to me.
So how did you go from being his close friend to making this movie?
I mean, I was already shooting the movie before it already happened. My brother had got shot, and
So I just wanted to talk about my brother and my friends that have been shot by a gun. So Timothy, the whole situation with Timothy had occurred, and so I felt like I wanted to talk about what happened to Timothy. And
what happened as you made this film? Did it change your view of your neighborhood, of your own life?
Yeah, I mean, I just showed like the the actual like view, like how you can be gone within like a couple of seconds from like a gun, like, you know. And I'm just trying to take it around and just show everybody like guns is a bad thing. And
so yesterday you were in Brooklyn on Ralph Avenue.
Yes.
All these kids say they know people killed by guns, they know people who have guns, and you're taking it all over.
Yes.
And you were there when he was shot, right? And in terms of your recollection of those moments and what you heard in the police reports afterwards, what were the main differences?
I mean, I just know now. I know how, you know, how they try to cover up stories and try to switch up stories and try to say, you know, I mean, I was there. I know what happened from detail to detail. So I mean, like, just by reading what happened, and, I mean, majority of that stuff really didn't happen. Like,
did the police ever identify themselves when they came?
No.
Never.
Fine. I didn't even know it was police that did it until I heard the walkie-talkies, and then when I got into my apartment, then I seen it.
What do you hope will come out of this film? And now, I mean, you showed it at Sundance. It's gotten international acclaim. Now you're taking it to poor neighborhoods. You're showing it on the side of the DC TV cybercar. You're showing the film on the streets.
Yeah, I mean, I just hope that this just be the last, like, no tragic thing that ever happened to a young teen in our community. I mean, if we don't try to do something to stop this, they're going to keep continue killing us. So that's why I'm just trying to take this around and show everybody what they're doing to us and how can we make things better.
And do you get a sense from the teenagers that you speak to how the guns are getting into the neighborhoods?
I mean, there's a lot of feedback when I ask that question. I mean, they really don't know how it's getting into our communities, but I mean, it's here.
Phyllis Claiborne, what do you hope is going to come out of the film and of any kind of investigation, if it ever happens?
Well, I'm hoping that we can teach our kids that there are so many more things in life that we can do besides pull out a gun and shoot someone. Whether it be a police officer killing your child, whether your child is killing another child with guns, guns are dangerous. We have to get them off the streets because we are at war. We are at war more so than over there in the other countries. We are at war here. And we have to kind of like put ourselves together and say, well, enough is enough. We have to put it to the people who really can do something about it and say, enough is enough. The guns are killing our children. It just has to be a put to a stop. Guns are very dangerous. And we just have to, like I said, focus on the children, from them to the next generation, to the next generation, that guns aren't the answer. There are much more things that you can do. Well, positive things.
I want to thank you both very much for being with us. Terrence Fisher, director of Bullets in the Hood, a Bed-Stuy story. We'll link at our website, democracynow.org, to your tour and to information about the film. Phyllis Claiborne, her son Timothy Stansbury, was shot dead by a police officer on the roof of a Bedford-Stuyvesant housing project, January 2004. He was 19. Thanks both for being with
you.
Us.
Thank you.
That does it for today's broadcast. For a copy of the program, you can go to our website at democracynow.org. Democracy Now! Is produced by Mike Burke, Sharifa Bokadous, John Hamilton, Elizabeth Press, Yoruba Richin, Frank Lopez, Jenny Utes, Nick Marsilio, and Mike DeFilippo are our engineers. Special thanks to Danielle Strandberg Peshkin and Megan Whitney. Tonight, I'll be at University of California, Davis at Freeburn Hall talking about Guantanamo. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez. Thanks for joining us.